everybody. Welcome to Stale Bubblegum. I'm John Chapman. Today's guest is pretty much as good as it gets. I actually told a buddy of mine who is coming on, and that's exactly what he said. This gentleman is pretty much synonymous with baseball, and I could sit here and blow a lot of smoke, and I almost want to, just to see how cringeworthy this interview can get. But I won't. Tom Verducci, how are you, my friend?
I am doing well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for jumping on. So I know the season is kind of in its infancy here, but I already feel like it's been, I guess I want to say, kind of strange. I guess in a good way. What's your hot take on the season so far with, I guess, the teams who are, I'll say, overachieving, which kind of sounds mean. And I'll just say, just, you know, the rule changes and kind of all that stuff.
Yeah, I almost feel like the soundtrack should be from something from Duran Duran, because I'm having a flashback to the 1980s.
Right.
And it's a good thing. And it's not just the time of game, of course. I mean, we're shaving, 25 minutes off the average time of game.
Right.
But it's the style of the game. Definitely the ball is in play at a quicker pace. But we're seeing stolen bases. We're seeing a premium on defense. You have to defend the running game. You have to defend the field without a shift. I like the fact that we have teams like Arizona, Cleveland, Texas, the Cubs, that are really leveraging speed and athleticism and defense into winning baseball. It's pretty cool to see. But the best thing, really, you can't underestimate the impact the pitch timer has had in the game. If you're a fan of the game, it's a lot easier to stay engaged. I like to say the game is played with a heightened sense of readiness. What we've done is taken essentially 25 minutes of dead time out of the game. I mean, in one fell swoop, it's a completely different game if you're under 40. If you're over 40, you're just like, this is the way it's supposed to be.
Right.
So I'm digging the fact that we cut out all the dawdling. I've been on that for years. As much as I love the game, it just slowed to a terrible pace in terms of not just connecting to new fans, but really we were losing people who were baseball fans because they didn't want to sit through 3.5 and sometimes 4 hours and seeing a ball put in play every 5 minutes. And believe me, I've heard from friends, even people in baseball that I know in the last few years, who said they weren't watching baseball because it was a difficult watch. And now if you watch either in person or on television, you notice, as I said, there's this heightened sense of readiness where you know the next pitch is coming soon, maybe the next ball in play. But the anticipation that something's coming next is really cool. That's a game changer.
Yeah, you know, I noticed right off the bat, I was at a game, I guess, a couple of weeks ago. It used to be you can leave to get stuff at the concession. You would come back and you missed basically half an inning. I left it. I missed about an inning and a half. So I guess that right there is something. But it is true. Like, I mean, it is kind of a time warp. It reminds me of when I used to go to games as a kid. And I think I was at the game and home within 3 hours, which is,
yeah, and that's a big
cool
thing. It's a big thing that that can happen. And I've noticed that the games I've been at in April on weeknights, always the least attended games. The weather's not great in a lot of the cities. People have work, kids have school. So first of all, it's a tough ticket to sell. But when you think about what you just said, if you go to the game and you think if it's going to take 3 or 3.5 hours, you start doing the math about getting out of the parking lot or getting on whatever transit you took to get there, what time you're going to get home and work and school the next day, you're like, forget it. But now some teams actually are starting games at 6:30, 6:40, and you pretty much know 2:30, 2:40, games over, you can get home at a decent hour. And I've noticed that these weeknight games, I haven't checked whether the attendance is up, but I have noticed that late in the game, more people are sticking around. And I've always said that one of the bad things about baseball the last few years is that it's the only sport where people will pay money to attend the event and they will leave a competitive game, right? People don't walk out of a football game, an NBA game, an NHL game that's, you know, a very close game late in the game because they're looking at their watch and saying, I have to get home. that happens in baseball. I mean, think about that. Paying your money to see, it's like walking out of a really good movie. This movie's too long. I don't want to see how it ends. It's a bad commentary on baseball, but now I think people are much more apt, A, to buy a ticket, and B, actually to see a close game to its conclusion.
Yeah. So going back to one of those things that I pointed out, there are a lot of teams who are competing, at least right now. Do you think it'll carry over? I know it's hard to say. I mean, you know, the Pirates and the Diamondbacks and teams like this. Do you think that they can go the long haul? I can't believe I just said the Pirates, but you know, do you think some of these teams can actually at least compete for the whole season?
Well, when you think about it, with six playoff spots, you can play 500 baseball for 3, even 4 months, and you're on the outskirts of a potential postseason bid. So that's possible for a lot of these teams. I think Texas, Arizona, Baltimore wouldn't surprise me if they're in the playoffs. Pittsburgh, I would be surprised, and take nothing away from their start. And I always say a team becomes dangerous when they go from thinking they're competitive to knowing they are. And that was Baltimore last year. I'm not sure if Pittsburgh is there yet, but with each week they seem to be getting there. I just think the course of the season, the lack of depth really shows up with some of these teams, the smaller payroll teams. It's very hard to maintain, you know, a full complement of players entire season. And I think that probably will be Pittsburgh's undoing. I could be totally wrong. Look how long Baltimore stayed in the race last year when people thought they were going to disappear. Two years ago, it was San Francisco. There's no way they can keep it up. 107 wins later, there they were in the postseason. So I don't want to rule anything out, but I do think the expanded playoff field has really changed the calculus midseason. So teams like Arizona, Pittsburgh, I can't say Texas because they've already spent a lot of money, but teams that find themselves in a race, I think the incentive there now is to go ahead and stay in the race by making a move. Now, last year, Baltimore surprised a lot of people. They trade their closer and their cleanup hitter in a race, but they were honest enough to say, you know what, this is not our year yet. We're a year ahead of schedule. We're not going to push the envelope. Let's make sure we're really good to compete next year. That's a difficult decision for teams to make, and especially to sell your fans. So I think that Pittsburgh would be interesting to watch around the trade deadline. They could be like Baltimore last year, to be super honest with themselves, to say we're a year ahead of schedule. Let's continue to take another step forward. Or maybe they push the chips in and say we're going to be all in. But I think both Arizona and Texas are two teams, and I'll throw Baltimore in there as well. I think, yes, we're going to be looking at those teams in August and saying they still have a shot at the postseason.
You think we're going to be following Anaheim? I feel like every single game is just like any loss is the Ohtani, you know, trade watch. Do you think that's just going to continue the whole way? I guess so, right?
Yeah, you know, listen, I don't think they're a bad team where we're going to write them off. And I don't think they're a great team where we think that they're a playoff team. I think they pretty much are what they are from what I have seen so far. They're right around 500, so that keeps them in the outskirts of the race. You know, I think they'll make moves if they need to. I think they will be active, just especially because the Ohtani ticking clock that the season is being played under. But, you know, Houston has gotten off to a slow start, so maybe the number it takes to win the West and to stay in that race is a little bit number than what we all thought. I mean, they haven't been close to Houston in the last couple of years, but that gap is come back because Houston has come back. But yeah, I mean, right now, from what I've seen from the Angels, on any given night, let's face it, with that lineup, you know, Ohtani and Trout can win a game by themselves, especially when Ohtani's on the mound. So they're not going to be bad. We're not going to be able to write this team off, and he won't be traded in July. But as constituted right now, I'm not sure they're better than Texas. I'm not sure they're better than Houston. It'll be tough for them to get to the postseason. The American League is – it's deep, man. And I think that even the second wild card number is going to be pretty high this year.
Yeah. You know, going to you for a little bit since you know, my intro to you, which was kind of weird but true, is so much about baseball. Really, you've kind of been like the soundtrack in a lot of ways, with your writing and just covering baseball, and the game has changed so much. How has writing and how has covering the sport changed in terms of for you? Because the game has changed so much.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I like to tell people that the game in the last 5 years has changed more than it has in my first 37 years covering baseball. And I really mean that, because the way that the game is taught, the strategy of the game, the technology of the game, it's a very, very different game. And I think as far as covering the game, you have to be aware of that. So your experiences always help, but you can't think it's the same game that you were covering in the 80s or the 90s or 2010s. So you have to be nimble, just like other teams are now. The turnover is tremendous in the game. It's hard to keep up with the number of pitchers alone that come through the major leagues. So right. That's a challenge, and that's really a change in covering this sport. But I like to say, you know, the basics of covering baseball for me haven't changed. I think the idea is still to be informative first. Well, actually, truthful first, informative, and then you get to interesting and entertaining. And listen, platforms have changed. We know that people get their baseball information in many different ways now than the way it used to be. You know, I started out in the newspaper business, so things are very different from that era. But what hasn't changed is people like a good story that's well told. And the skill of telling that, I think, will always be in demand. And how does that come about? Well, it starts with reporting. I mean, I actually feel like I was lucky enough to come up in the newspaper world, especially in New York, in the tabloid environment. I always say that's like the equivalent for a Marine of going to Camp Lejeune. I mean, that's boot camp. You know, you learn how to fail, which is an important part for anybody starting out in business. But you also learn to be diligent, to be competitive, to really hustle, learn from your mistakes very quickly and move on. It was a great training ground. And I think those reporting skills, even in today's high-tech world with multi-platforms, is still, you know, to me, the coin of the realm, because we're in a business that relies on interacting with people, having people tell their stories, whether it's coaches, managers, players, and gaining trust and doing right by those people is still super important. Delivery methods obviously have changed, and I think interest has changed. Unfortunately, people don't read as much as they did back in the day. You just hardly see newspapers around to begin with, but just reading in general has diminished. People want things a lot quicker. People are more visual learners. I get all that. I'm not saying it's worse. It's just different. But you learn to adapt. I mean, I was someone who started out never thinking I wanted to do anything on television. But back then, you either did one or the other. And my first love was in print journalism. And things change, and the world changes, and you have to adapt. And everything is a challenge. And even though I didn't expect to be doing television, I've enjoyed the challenge.
Do you feel now anyone, not necessarily breaking into the field, you kind of have to do everything now, right? Would you agree with that?
I do agree with that. And I encourage, you know, journalism students or anybody who wants to be in the business to be nimble and to be able to go in different directions. And yeah, I think communication skills across the board are very valuable. I guess because I'm partial to it, writing is still super important. Even if you're on television, I think there's an element of writing to it. I think the craft of writing will serve you well, and paying attention to writing. But yeah, I do think having varied abilities really helps. It's interesting. I say that at the same time, I recognize that also specialization has taken over in the business. You know, people want their information from experts. It's hard to be a generalist, if you will. When I started out, the general sports columnist was sort of at the top of the pyramid in the journalism world. You know, the Dick Young or Mike Lupica at a Daily News who could write about, you know, the Yankees one day and the Jets or Knicks or Rangers another day. And people look to those voices to share their opinions about all the local teams. Well, now I feel like people really want experts, and they want people, and sometimes who are experts within a field on a certain way, you know, a pitching expert, an injury expert, a trade expert, you know. So I wouldn't advise people starting out to narrow in on one thing, but eventually you might find yourself doing that because I think that's what the audience prefers. But yeah, I like to tell people having a variety of skills and a variety of interests and being able to go in any direction, because the field is just super competitive, that if you narrow your skills or certainly narrow your options, it's going to be much more difficult.
Yeah. I mean, I think last offseason, alone, spending some time on Twitter is, I think talking about quote unquote experts, that was a real trip in terms of everyone being an expert and everyone knowing who's going where and everyone having insight in Correa's ankle and just trying to scoop everybody. It really it was fascinating to me as I'm a Met fan, and just watching the lack of real news was amazing, just on Twitter alone, and just trying to like get something real was really kind of impossible. Not that you can really get that from Twitter anyway, but just trying to find like kind of like a light in the darkness was really tough. So it is really, really difficult to find, actual real sources out there. They exist, but everyone's an expert, I guess.
Yeah, that's kind of a good thing in a way, as long as you take it for what it is. Differences of opinion are interesting. I mean, we all should, unfortunately, it doesn't happen enough. We all should feel challenged if somebody comes with a different viewpoint. It's like, what am I missing here? But sometimes you're like, you'd rather not hear it. I get that. Yeah, it's an interesting world out there where there are many more megaphones out there. So it can get confusing, and sometimes people feel like they have to shout louder than everybody else, even if their information isn't as good or better, but they can be noticed by being the loudest. So there's some of that competition that goes on too.
In your career, just shifting gears a little bit, in your career, have you been I mean, obviously you've covered World Series and all this stuff. You've called World Series. Have you been a fan and like literally a fan rooting for a team and had to hide it? Like actually, you're obviously a professional, but like, is there a line where between fanboy and professional, Mr. Baseball?
You know, it's interesting. People, I think fans would find this like weird and think I'm lying, but no, I'm not a fan of any team, and it's very easy for me. It makes baseball for me so much more enjoyable. I actually find it's kind of weird that people are so invested in a team because to me it's about baseball. And when the game is over, I'm always happy. I don't care who wins or loses. I go to a baseball game to find out, how guys do what they do, the narrative of a single baseball game and how it will play out and end up. I root for extra innings. I want to see more baseball. So I never get frustrated. I never get angry with a loss. I never blame anybody for a loss. And I feel lucky that way. It's like I can enjoy the sport for the sport itself, and not, as Jerry Seinfeld said, root for the laundry. People will adopt some players that they hated just because they happen to now be traded to their team. And when you're a fan of a team, it's a very powerful thing when you think about it. You love everything about that team, right? I mean, you get frustrated. Don't get me wrong, the team's not doing well. You get frustrated. But you're going to root for everything about that team. Your uniform's the best, your general manager's the best, your players are the best. It's a very interesting dynamic. It's a powerful one. It binds people together, and that's what's great about it. But I almost feel like I'm lucky not to be in that vortex because it's very easy for me to go to a baseball game and not care who wins or loses. And it's a really cool way to enjoy the sport.
It doesn't ever come to a point though where you kind of I don't know, I just would get a little attached to some of the, some of the great
Well,
stories, you know? I don't
yeah,
know.
I think there's no question that I will root for good stories. I mean, I'm a writer, so I want the good narratives. I mean, I want a seven game series. I mean, sweeps are boring in the postseason, right? So, in a vacuum, yeah, I'm rooting for the most interesting dynamic story. I want to see a team come from behind late in the game. So, yeah, I'm happy about that. The 18 inning World Series game with the Dodgers in 2018, I wanted that thing to go on forever. I
And
was
you're
hoping
rooting
somebody
for a no
won.
hitter. You're rooting for a no hitter just because
Absolutely.
that's the good baseball story, though.
Yeah. So stories, absolutely. And even sometimes, like if I'm working on a feature story on somebody, it helps if that guy does really well, if I'm there reporting the story out. So yeah, you'd like to see that person at that particular point in time do well. So narrative driven, absolutely. I would like things to go in a certain direction, but it's wholly outside of team driven.
But that couldn't have always been the case. You
well,
probably,
no. I mean, I grew up, I was a Mets fan.
Okay.
And I came about being a Mets fan because my father's cousin was married to Gil Hodges.
Oh, wow.
The first game I ever went to was Gil Hodges was managing the Washington Senators at the time, and they played at Yankee Stadium. And we went out there and we watched the Senators, I'm sure, probably lose to the Yankees. I don't remember the score, but I do remember going to the team bus outside the right field bullpen after the game and seeing Gil Hodges and Frank Howard. And it was just so cool to see kind of behind the curtain a little bit. And so Senators fan, and then he gets actually traded to the New York Mets, becomes the manager, and my brothers and I all became Mets fans. So I grew up a Mets fan because of that connection, really no other reason. And I was really young at the time, so that's all I knew.
Right.
But once I got into this business, it was just very easy for me. I mean, I just stopped being a Mets fan as I was growing up. And looked at the game very differently. And I think part of that comes from the fact that my father was a high school baseball and football coach. And I always looked at the game from the inside out, never from the outside in. I saw what it took to put a game plan together for a Saturday football game. I saw what it took to put a practice together for a baseball team. I saw how teams won and lost rather than just what happened on the field that day. So I saw everything from an insider's perspective growing up. And so that was why it was easy for me not to look at the game as an outsider, as a fan, but like as a coach. And I always think I look at the game with coach's eyes more than a fan's eyes.
Let's face it, Tom, it's easy to leave the Mets. I'm a Mets
fan.
I probably
saved myself a lot of frustration, yeah.
I was going to say, if I could find a way to leave the Mets, I would leave the Mets too. So from a baseball perspective, a baseball story perspective, what would like a great story be? Obviously the Pirates, like, I don't know why I keep mentioning the Pirates, I guess just because I'm stunned that they're doing so well, but what would be like a captivating story that you could think of kind of out of left field this year that would be compelling, or at least to you, where you'd be like, I never thought in a million years that I would even be reporting on that.
Yeah, I mean, there's certain, you know, different ways to answer that. I mean, the biggest story, I think, if you're Fox, and I work for Fox, would be a Yankees-Dodgers World Series. You're right. Just talking about audience size. A fascinating story would be to see Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani, not just in the postseason, because if they get in and they lose two wild card games, you know, they're home before you know
it.
That doesn't really have an impact. But to see them, like, in a World Series. Two of the biggest players in the game in a World Series. That would be huge. But I think that the soft spot is always for that team nobody sees coming, like a Pittsburgh Pirates. If they go on a run, you know, it's been a while since we've seen a team really like that, really come out of the blue. You know, teams seem to graduate steps towards getting to postseason appearances, especially a World Series. But yeah, I think that would be the most shocking thing if you saw one of these, you know, say a bottom three or four payroll team get all the way to the World Series. Now, it wouldn't be surprising to see the Tampa Bay Rays there, especially after the way they started.
Right.
But yeah, a team like Pittsburgh, and again, I'm going to date myself and my early fandom, but 1969 Mets, it's like the greatest Cinderella story ever, at least in baseball. You know, 100-1 odds or whatever they were, they wound up playing this loaded Baltimore Orioles team and win the World Series that nobody saw coming.
Right.
So the Pirates would kind of be, I think, you know, probably, I think, the best case scenario if you're talking about a team nobody saw coming.
Since I threw my own team under the bus, where do you see the Mets right now? I mean, obviously they kind of had a good West Coast trip. Slipped up last night, but where do you see them as a team? Do you see them as a complete team?
I think they're a very deep team, and that really stands out to me. They've already had a bunch of injuries, obviously, especially with the rotation, but they've weathered them really well. I think the core group now has been together long enough. They know who they are. They know how to win games. Any kind of a losing streak won't bother this group. I think the one downside to this team is their age. And with age, you're going to get a higher injury risk. There's no question about that. It's a matter of how they get through the season with, and I know people talk about Max Scherzer and Justin Verlander, but it's beyond that. You know, we've seen that with Quintana, we've seen that with Carrasco, but a lot of their position players are a little bit older. So the Mets to me are, they're not going anywhere. I mean, they'll have moments maybe where they don't look good, but they showed to that West Coast trip how resilient they are. They find a lot of different ways to win games. Like they have a variety of ways to win games. So I'm not sure they're still that they've closed the gap on the Braves. I just have tremendous respect for what the Braves are doing. And Spencer Strider looks like he's a real difference maker right now. But yeah, I think the Mets are, if they don't get to 100 wins, they're going to be right there again. I don't see them. I don't see a gap really opening up in that division. I think it's going to be a very close race like last year.
I think it'd be nice, obviously, for me, if Buck won a World Series ring, just kind of like Dusty did. But again, just for me, if that could happen, that'd be nice.
I mean, it's great. I mean, Brian Snitker, another baseball right. lifer, right? Yep. I mean, it's great to see these guys who really dedicate their lives. And that's not an exaggeration. You like to see them rewarded for all the work they put in.
I guess one of my last questions, and totally just out of nowhere, any weird stories that you can share with us that kind of happened during your career or on air that I don't know if you had to pivot while you were on air or anything that you could share?
I don't know about on air.
Baseball is just such a wacky sport. It could even just be like anything in your travels.
Well, I don't know. It's hard to think of anything that was really that weird. I remember, I think it was my first road trip. I was working for Newsday and covering Yankee series in Toronto. And back then, the computers that we have were like the size of a small suitcase, almost like a typewriter, if you will. It was not a typewriter. I haven't been around that long. But I remember it had a handle on it, so I figured I'd put it through check baggage. It actually went through check baggage and made it there. I mean, it was probably the dumbest thing I've ever done, but that was my first road trip, and that was definitely a rookie mistake. And the other thing is, I got to give credit to Bob Costas, because the first game that I did in the booth was back in 2009. It was a crazy game, Dodgers and Phillies. I'll have to look up, but it was like both teams scored double digit runs. It was back and forth. It was a great game call, but it was crazy. There was a lot going on, and that was my first game in the booth. And to do it with Bob Costas, it was like getting called up from A-ball. You know, and you're the catcher and you're working with, Pedro Martinez or some Hall of Fame pitcher. And there I am trying to call the game with Bob Costas. But I'll never forget that in the course of the game and all these changes, crazy game, he misidentified one of the Phillies pinch hitters who had come out on deck. He didn't realize it was a pinch hitter, and in his scorebook, he had the next guy coming up, and he misidentified that person when the camera showed the on deck hitter. And I could see once he realized that he was really mad at himself. He really took it hard. And then he told me after the game, he and this is what he always did. He would get a DVD of the game and he'd go back and he'd look at it. He'd try to pick out what he did right, what he did wrong, and just kind of critique himself. And that really stood out to me because, you know, Bob Costas is Bob Costas, right? He's right. One of the best that's ever done this. And, It was an important lesson for me to see that really caring about what you do, even when you've been so established, it never goes out of style. And that was, I was lucky enough to get to know Vin Scully pretty well as well, and did a feature on him in his last year. And it was the same kind of thing. I was like, man, how do you be so good for so long? Vin Scully was doing, I think he was still the best after 40 something years of calling games. It was amazing. And he said something that really stuck with me and I've never forgot it. His answer, he actually quoted Laurence Olivier about how you could be this good for this long. He said, it is the humility to prepare and the confidence to pull it off. And I never forgot that. It was something I felt like I knew internally, but never really stop to think about it. And you think about what it means. The humility to prepare means you're not coasting. You know what you don't know. You never take anything for granted. You know, Bob Costas, Vince Scully, you would think could take things for granted, and they don't, and they never did it. That stood out to me. I take that to mean in what I do, preparation is a lot of research and being prepared for a lot of things that might never happen in the game. But if they do, you're ready for it. And then the confidence to pull it off. I mean, we all need mentors. We all need family. We all need people around us who believe in us. That's how we get a lot of opportunities. But there has to be something within you as well. And for me, going on television and you're on live and, you know, you're on at that moment, you're on your own at that point. You know, you prepare for it, but you need something within you intrinsically to say, I can do this, I can do it well. So that stuck with me. That Vince Scully, I thought, as usual, found the perfect right words to figure out and explain how you could be doing something so well for so long.
And did anything ever happen to you unexpected on the air or no?
Yeah, I guess when I was doing the World Series, we lost power. We were in Kansas City. Right. And it was like they must have forgot to feed the squirrels who were running the generator that day. In the middle of the game, pow, we're off the air. And I think it was Matt Vasgersian and whoever else was doing the international feed.
Yeah.
Literally had to walk into our seats in the World Series booth and pick up the telecast because the international feed was up. But yeah, that's something that was pretty weird. You do the World Series game and the power goes out.
Oh man, I remember that. That was 2015, right?
Yeah, it was in Kansas City. I mean, it wasn't out for that long, but I want to say it was maybe a half inning. It was more than just a little blip.
Oh man, that's crazy. So I guess last question, what to you is your favorite play like in baseball?
I guess my favorite play is a relay play to the plate on an extra base hit, a ball in the gap, because at that moment, everybody is moving. And it really is an orchestrated ballet when it's done well. There was a game in the 2001 World Series, Great Diamondbacks Yankees World Series, where Derek Jeter threw a guy out at third base, I think trying to go from first to third, or maybe he was trying to stretch a double into a triple. And just the throw to him and the way he caught the ball and turned while catching it and threw an absolute missile straight to third base, the runner would head for a slide. I just thought that was so cool. To me, that's so much better than a home run. I mean, a home run just happens out of the blue. You don't see anything developing. And then everything stops and the guy gets the stage for himself to run around the bases. I love the fact that the ball's in the gap and you're not even aware of it, but you're doing the calculus in your head. Like, how long is it going to take for that ball to get back in? And how far can the runners get? And should they advance another base? I mean, you're like a third base coach in your own head. But I like the fact that for a game that relies a lot on anticipation, a lot of the excitement and power in baseball is thinking, what's going to happen next? What will he throw? What would I do in that situation? Who should be the pitcher? Whatever it is, you're kind of always looking ahead. So anticipation is a big part of baseball's attraction. But in that moment, baseball's as exciting as any other sport because there's so many bodies in motion. So I love the ball in the gap with runners on base. And I don't know how long it takes, probably no more than, I don't know, 8 to 10 seconds.
I was going to say a couple seconds, yeah.
Yeah, but that's a cool moment for me when so many people are moving and everybody's got a responsibility, or it should, to be in a certain spot. And going back to the Jeter play to get Giambi at the plate in Oakland in postseason, the flip play, another great example. You know, right place, right time, not by happenstance, but by sort of baseball IQ.
I don't mean to deflate the balloon a little bit, but what's your least favorite play?
Oh, least favorite play.
It's such a James Lipton kind of question, but
yeah, I mean, probably the mid-inning pitching change. Because usually that means there's a rally going on and everything all of a sudden stops and you got to wait for the guy to come in and, you know, 8 warm-up pitches. There's no pitch clock on his warm-up pitches, right? So right. Even now in today's speed-up game, that could really slow things down. Yep. I wouldn't try to come up with any kind of a rule. I know people say, what's the deal with warm-up pitches? Like in the NFL, when they change quarterbacks, does a guy get to stop the game and warm up on the field?
Right.
Or a field goal kicker get to take a few kicks before he actually goes ahead and attempts? Well, I wouldn't want to change the rules, but I'd say the beginning pitching change.
I love it. And who's your favorite team? I'm just kidding. Tom, you are the man. I have a journalism degree, and I've been following you for a while. I don't think you're that much older than me, but I've been following you forever and on TV and everything. So you're the man. You really
well,
are.
Well, thanks. I know I'm lucky at what I do. I knew since I was actually as long as I can remember, I was a really little kid, this is what I wanted to do. And it just broke right for me. And so I really feel blessed. So, and thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thanks for coming on.